I remember my recollection being, wow, I can't believe they're allowed to do this, because many of the tactics that they're using to monetize the game are things that are actually not allowed for casinos because they're regulated against. To spin a wheel or open a random box to maybe get the thing I need. To me, those are probably the things that are most concerning because they're integrating so many more elements of gambling within their model.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the One Day at a Time podcast. Today's guest is Robert Jacobson. He's the executive director of the California Council on Problem Gambling, and we're going to be having a conversation today about video games and gambling. Robert, thanks for joining.
Hey Rob, thanks for having me on. Appreciate the opportunity to speak on this topic.
Yeah, of course. And for those that are kind of wondering why we're talking about this, Robert and I were having a conversation probably about 3 months back, maybe, about how we're seeing video games not only change to involve more gambling type behaviors, but also they've had them forever. And we're just kind of, as a society, maybe noticing them a little bit more now. Robert, you want to talk to that a little bit? Like, what's been going on from what you've seen with video games and gambling?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say kind of the way you introduced the topic, like change to, but have always had. That's really a great kind of linear talking point right out the gate. So the way this conversation actually started, the conversation that occurred a few months ago, the topic we were discussing at that time was The Legend of Zelda. I grew up in the time when the original Nintendo console was the video gaming console. And I still remember playing the original Legend of Zelda. My one memory of that was of sitting in a cave and gambling all day long. And I kind of remember the game had like 9 worlds or levels or whatever. And I never made it past world 1 because all I did was sit in that cave and gamble. That mechanic, that's like one of the classic. It's the epitome of like the original video game. And that mechanic has been in gaming since the very beginning, or as close to the very beginning as we can get of kind of like the nascent version of modern graphics. So I don't think there was gambling in Pong, for example, but by the time we reached Nintendo, it was there. You know, that's evolved quite a bit over the years to be incorporated into a variety of other games, but things began to change somewhere around the early 2000s, or maybe like 2005-ish, somewhere around there. Games began to monetize off of gambling mechanics. Now, I have no idea what the first game to do it was. I have no idea how it was done, but I can tell you the first game that I came across with it was a game called Evony, E-V-O-N-Y.
Okay.
This was a game I actually personally played with friends of mine over 15 years ago, sometime around 2008, give or take. And at the time, I was working in the gaming industry. So you mentioned now I'm with the California Council on Problem Gambling, which I've been for 15 years, but I worked in the gaming industry for 15 years prior to that. I remember my recollection being, wow, I can't believe they're allowed to do this, because many of the tactics that they're using to monetize the game are things that are actually not allowed for casinos because they're regulated against. There are decades of research that have been conducted by like gaming equipment manufacturers and casinos as to how to better engage their guests. Now, I'm not going to say they're trying to research how to make people more addicted, but they're, like all businesses, trying to research how to make the gambling experience better, the entertainment experience better, and ultimately to make more money, because they're businesses. And in the course of this research, they will learn that there are things that can make people more addicted, that can influence their decision-making process and ultimately lead them towards going beyond their comfort levels. Mm-hmm. Many of those things have been regulated against, meaning that casinos simply cannot do them, whether they want to or not. They're just not allowed to.
Sure.
That's in the casino industry. But in the video game industry, those regulations don't exist. They've never been implemented. They've never, to the best of my knowledge, really been considered, except for one brief period for a couple of years after Star Wars video game came out with loot boxes, which is something we'll probably talk about later. Cool. And the term loot box got into, you know, societal vernacular. And there was some regulation looked at that point. But Generally speaking, video games, a lot of people still view them as, because it's all virtual and there's no money that you can win back or that you can receive back, they still tend to think of them in a different bucket than gambling. Mm-hmm. Now, we could go down a different path in this conversation and talk about things like skins gambling, like Counter-Strike Go, and how those skins have real world value. You go trade them in on a gambling website and then gamble with the money that you have from the skin. But apart from that, what I would argue is that as years go by and generations change, you know, the definition of gambling has always been when you risk something of value to gain something of value when the outcome is uncertain. It doesn't have to be money. It just has to be something that you value. And video games have really integrated themselves into society in a way that we now value the things that we get within those games, which means that they offer a form of gambling that's unregulated.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And, you know, before we move on and dive into that rabbit hole of skins gambling, what were some of the in-game mechanics that you're pointing towards as the things that weren't being regulated within the game, Ebony?
There are some things that are heavily regulated and some that are lightly or not regulated in this area of kind of over-engagement, we can call it, within your spend for gambling or for video games. And there's something called a near-miss phenomenon. That one is, to the best of my knowledge, not regulated in most markets. But for anybody who's not familiar with it, what it means, and this has been clinically proven with brain scans, is that when you're gambling, or at least when a problem gambler is gambling, they get the exact same reaction from almost winning as they do from winning. So in the most traditional, easiest example to give, if you picture a classic slot machine, like a one-armed bandit with three red sevens, and you get red seven, and then the third red seven is one notch above. You don't win, but the excitement you get in that moment as the seven is dropping is equal to, from a brain chemistry reactive standpoint, as if you won the jackpot.
And that's probably wildly confusing for someone that doesn't have a gambling problem to try to consider, right? Like, because it makes sense to me, because I mean, you're on my podcast, you know, I have a gambling problem and I'm in recovery. But to someone that doesn't understand it, like, oh, that's so hard to figure out, right? It's like, you lost, but you feel like you won. It's like, it feels like almost like you won.
I would argue that there is an analogy out there that every single person could relate to. I don't know that I have a broad one off the top of my head. I'm trying to think of one right now. But, you know, think about a movie or a TV show or an event, a sporting event, the Super Bowl, whatever, something that you've been waiting for a long time. You're really excited about it. A sporting event might be a great example. Let's say you're a lifelong fan, Golden State, you know, let's go back to when Golden State got hot, right? Lifelong Golden State fan, or Cleveland. That's a better one. When Cleveland won their first championship, you know, it doesn't matter. Lifelong fan of a sporting event. And then right as the game is about to start, think about that level of excitement that you have at the moment that the game starts. Now, you may be enthusiastic and ecstatic if your team wins, but realistically, are you that much more elevated at the moment of victory than you were at the moment of tip-off? Or first pitch or something like that.
It's the thrill of anticipation and
uncertainty,
the excitement behind it's, they're both forms of excitement. They're maybe a little difference. It's the excitement of winning versus the excitement of uncertainty finding out, but having that anticipation quenched is that release of feeling feel good chemicals. You know, it's the dopamine that goes off in the brain.
The difference is in how you remember and view it, but not in how your body processes it. Because in both cases, it's the dopamine, but then the memories that form are different.
Sure. So you're saying that this fallacy is plugged into some of these video games then?
Absolutely, yes. Now, and I don't want to jump around topics too much because your question was, Ebony, but the easiest examples to give here would just be social casinos.
Sure.
So if we went to a social casino, what you would find when you downloaded the casino is that pretty much every piece of research that has been found in the past 70 years to engage people to a higher level of play is being incorporated because they're not prohibited. So you will see a level of near miss that is going to be not greater than 45% and not lower than 30%. Why? Because we know that people will get numb to that near miss phenomenon if it occurs too frequently. So they will ratchet it up to the highest level that they can. You will see another thing that we know is that somebody who experiences a big win early in their gambling career or a very large win really at any point in their gambling career is more likely to develop a problem because if it happened once, it can happen again. So you download any social casino and you will find that you are consistently winning for a period of, it varies by the app, of course, but an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours a day. You're going to be winning in a variety of ways because they're blitzkrieging you with not just wins from the slot machines, but then from concurrent level ups and badge events and a variety of other ways to continue bringing in more coins.
And so a social casino, for those that don't know, is like, it's like gambling, but you're using like coins or tokens, right? Instead of real money.
Yeah, it's a video game slot machine.
Got it.
So it's just like if you could download a casino and then not win money. You could spend money to play, but you couldn't win real money, only virtual currency, basically. So the coins in this case would be virtual currency. What you'll find is, you know, you download it, you're going to get those near misses, you're going to get the higher win. And then the next thing they're going to be offering you is the ability to bet more. So every time you play, you gain experience. Your experience will accrue towards gaining levels. The more levels you gain, the higher your maximum wager goes, and the more slot machines that open up and that you can play. So you're incentivized to play more to open up more slot machines. And then those new slot machines will have, again, higher max wagers. And they will ensure that you have a steady flow of virtual currency coming in at continually escalating levels for a period of time. They will almost universally begin with very large numbers and then expand into astronomical numbers. So you might start with 1 million coins. And in another app, you might start with 1 billion coins. The one with the million will grow you up to 1 billion. The one with 1 billion will grow you up to 1 trillion. It's going to follow the same trajectory either way. But you start with a low number, and then they establish a price value to buy more of that currency at that initial low number.
But with in the real meantime, money.
With real money. Yes, with real money. So to buy another 1 million coins might only be $1. And you're like, it's $1 to go play for an hour. Sure, that sounds great. $1 is good value for an hour. But because you're growing up to that point in the game, you're leveling up to that point in the game where you can now bet larger sums per spin, you may be at a point where you're used to betting 45 million coins per spin and having 10 billion coins in your virtual bank account. Mm-hmm. And buying 1 million coins just is not going to give you that same level of engagement, that same level of dopamine. And now you're going to be looking at packs that are $50 or $100. And so they're using these different forms of clinically proven ways to result in people engaging in more frequent play, higher levels of play, higher average bet, just to kind of push you forward. All the while at the start, you almost cannot lose because they know if you lose too quickly, you'll close the app and uninstall it. Yeah. So there is a thing called payback ratio. This is, you know, tied into a real casino slot machine. So it's usually calculated over 100 or 250,000 spins or some cases more. And so that's saying, you know, for every $250,000 wagered, we have to pay back. In most jurisdictions, it has to be somewhere between 90 and 98.5% payback ratio. That literally means that it cannot go over 98.5% either. In some cases, there's exceptions. Like in Las Vegas, they can go over, but they have to give disclosure. But you can't go over. And you can't run on a sliding scale. That's a really big one. If you see like a multi-game where you can choose different games within it, the overall machine, by some regulations in the past, would they be able to say, oh, well, the video poker pays 102, but the slot holds 88. So it averages out to 96. The higher level of payback creates a risk for the person playing.
What are the age requirements like on these games? Do you have to be 21 to play?
No. In most cases, there's probably a term of service somewhere that says you have to be either 13 or 18. I suppose in some jurisdictions, it may say 21. I'm not an expert on the law, particularly worldwide law, because these are global offerings. In most cases, it's going to be either 13 or 18, but there is no age verification. And since there's no cash out and there's no mechanism to actually identify whether or not you are the age that you've claimed to be, there's no enforcement mechanism.
Can we talk about something real for a minute? If your gambling has started to feel less like fun and more like stress, trust me, you're not alone. Millions of us know what it's like to say, just one more bet, or feel that urge that's really difficult to explain. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Evive, a sponsor of today's video. Think of it as having a recovery companion right in your pocket, someone who actually understands what you're going through. No lectures, no pressure, just practical tools and genuine support when those challenging moments hit. Download Evive now and you'll get guaranteed free access through 2026. Not a trial or a limited version, but the complete platform, completely free. Because Evive believes that everyone deserves access to support that works for them. Download Evive today and take the first step towards changing your relationship to gambling. Evive is only available in select countries. For those that don't know, essentially the younger that you are introduced to gambling, the younger you start doing it, the more likely it is that you will develop a problem. And so these games, whether they are a funnel into actual casino play or not, they are developing some sort of dependency on the feeling that they're getting from these games. Is that fair?
That's exactly accurate. Yeah.
We've gone down the social casino route, which is, as we mentioned, a video game. But let's look at things like CSGO or Fortnite or games with loot box mechanics. And then we can take it a step further and talk about actual skins gambling. What's the current state of things with video game economies right now?
So probably the first thing we should do is define loot box. So loot box is the term in common vernacular. And I know I brought this up earlier without defining it as well. And what a loot box is a virtual box that contains loot. You're going to purchase a pack is the most commonly used term. So you're going to purchase a pack that will contain a number of virtual items within the game that you're playing. But the specific items that you receive will be randomized with high levels of variance. Oftentimes you may see something as infrequent as 0.01% probability of receiving it. You may have a number of opportunities to execute that 0.01%. In a lot of cases, the odds of receiving those items will be posted, but not in all cases. And some of that depends on the country of the developer and the size of the game. And then there is no verification mechanic that I am personally aware of to ensure that the games are honoring the posted rates regardless. Loot box became a popularized term because of the game Star Wars. So Star Wars being what it is, EA Sports, I believe it was, had won a contract bid to build the game Star Wars. And they incorporated loot boxes into the game behind another term that we would refer to as a paywall. So a paywall is a point in any game where you're just not able to progress further without paying oftentimes larger exorbitant sums of money. And oftentimes without encountering variance in your pursuit of crossing that threshold. It changes the linear trajectory of games. So I don't know how much of your audience might have a history with video games. Like some of them will have grown up on, you know, more current PlayStation 2 or PlayStation 3 or until about near the end of the life cycle of the PlayStation 4, I want to say. All console games followed a pretty simple formula. You would go to the store at first, and then later on you could do a virtual download. You would buy the game, you would get a set number of hours of gameplay, and then you would either get bored of the game, beat the game, whatever, and you would move on to the next game. Typically a game would cost 50, 60 bucks when it was new. Interestingly, that price virtually never changed. So at some point within the last 7 to 10 years, this concept of loot boxes and similar concepts, I should say more the concept of paywall, integrated itself into many video games. So actually the last console game I played was NBA 2K. And that game was so aggressively monetized, it's actually why I stopped playing console games. You could easily have spent $1,000 a day on that game and still not reach the level of progression that you were seeking. But what truly had changed is in those early examples I said, in the past you would buy a game, you would have some level of linear progression throughout the game and complete the game. In current games, you tend to just have like a teeny tiny level of progression until you reach the paywall, and then you spike all the way up, and then you have a teeny tiny level of progression again, and then you reach your next paywall, and you spike all the way up. And they've taken away a lot of the gameplay and replaced it with monetization. That is a concept that sparked with mobile apps. So it really sparked with Apple's introduction of in-app purchasing sometime around the iPhone 4 or 5, something like that.
Are these groups doing this to make massive, massive profits? Or are they doing this because they have to compete? Like, it just seems like someone would try to make their niche not charging for in-game items and then marketing that as the aspect to come play. But it seems like that's just the new thing to do.
So the truth of the matter is, I mentioned earlier, I can't really speak to the economics behind game development. It's not my area of expertise. I can only speak to, the end result. I think we can, intuit that there are millions, literally millions and millions of games that you can find on the App Store, Apple Store, et cetera. And I think just like everything else in life, everybody has a different goal. And the question that we could ask ourselves, which we in most cases probably will never know the answer to, but the question becomes, are they reinvesting in their product or are they cashing out of their product? Mm-hmm. And I think the truth of the matter is that you're going to see people at every point along the spectrum. Some who are just, flipping you over by the jeans and shaking out the last quarter and then, taking their profit. And some who are reinvesting every cent and winding up bankrupt because they can't bring in enough players and everybody in between.
I guess then the question is, like, are all of these mobile games monetizing the same way, or is there like kind of a line to draw between the way that they do it?
There's a variety of different business models. So the answer is no. The short answer is no, they're not all monetizing in the same way. You could kind of drop games into four or five different buckets. You had asked before if the app developers are monetizing in this fashion because they have to. You know, the short answer to this question is no, they don't all monetize in this way. They don't necessarily all need to monetize in this way, but scale matters. So it is possible, you know, I'd say that there's like five different buckets that you could talk about the monetization in, with the simplest one just being the single sale model. Like back in the old Nintendo original days, you go in, you buy a single game. It is possible to still do that, particularly with digital downloads. We see that on Steam a lot, but it's more difficult because it costs so much more to develop a video game these days. So if you have a game that cost you $10 million to develop, and then, you know, another $10 million to market, you have to make $20+ million back to break even, at which point, if you sell the game for $50 a pop, you have to sell what, 4 million copies or something, 400,000 copies or something like that. So it's a question of scale. If you have a game that was inexpensive to develop, you can do the single sale model. Or if you have a game that's anticipated enough and didn't cost that much. Then the next level would be something subscription-based. And off the top of my head, the best example of this would probably be something like World of Warcraft, which I believe still to this day has a really large player base. And at least the last time which is a few years back, but the last time I was aware of it, it never had in-app purchasing. It was just pay a monthly subscription fee. Again, you need scale. You need enough people paying that monthly subscription to support the game, but it's possible. Then you have games that will just sell you stuff. You know, we talked about like purchasing additional content. Mario Kart, for example, I don't think that you can buy a higher percentage chance to get a blue shell. You know, it's not randomized. What you can do is maybe buy additional tracks or buy additional carts or, you know, it's called DLC, I believe, downloaded content, something like that. So you can buy additional content within the game. Another good example of this would be Candy Crush. So Candy Crush was like the game that everybody talked about at the start of this revolution of in-app purchasing. And in some ways, I worry that it drew attention away from the next two levels we're going to talk about after this, because while I haven't played Candy Crush in a long time and it could have changed, at least the last time I saw or was familiar with the game, they told you what they were going to sell you and then they sold it to you. Did they make the levels harder so that maybe people were more encouraged to buy stuff? Probably. But there still wasn't that gambling mechanic of saying, you know, give us $30 and maybe you'll get the special bomb that you need to pass the next level. Then you get to those next two levels where you're going to have a level of monetization for a level of randomization that may be necessary to bypass a paywall, or you'll have a level of monetization for randomization because you're in direct competition with other players. And in a lot of ways, they're very similar. And in a lot of ways, they're not. If we think about escape versus action gamblers, those are basically monetizing to those two groups. Am I playing a game where I'm largely in isolation, or maybe there's a leaderboard, but I'm not in direct competition, but I just need to keep going on in this game? Or am I playing a game where there's a leaderboard and I'm in intense competition? Of course, now we get into those levels of randomization where it's like I'm paying a certain amount of money to spin a wheel or open a random box to maybe get the thing I need. To me, those are probably the things that are most concerning because they're integrating so many more elements of gambling within their model.
One thing that you kind of touched on earlier that I wanted to kind of make sure that we honed in on was CSGO. And the reason that I wanted to talk about it is because for those that don't know, CSGO is essentially one of these games where you buy the loot boxes, you hit the paywall in the game, and you get items. But very specifically with this one, those items can be transferred out of the game and directly onto an online casino and accepted as a form of currency. What have you seen as it relates to CSGO-based casino gambling?
Before I respond to that, I do think this is a great point to bring up something that's really important. Maybe we should have brought this up earlier, which is that there will be a certain portion of the audience watching right now whose minds are just blown at the concept of spending money on something virtual. Like, why would you ever do that? I want to emphasize that we're not really doing this with the intention of saying that it's bad to spend on a game, nor are we saying it's good to spend on a game. We're not trying to promote it or have judgment in either way. But within that, to help people understand why you might spend on a game, I would just ask you, have you ever spent a little bit extra on a good dinner and then digested it? Have you ever spent a little extra on a night out at the bar and it just creates a memory? It is, at the end of the day, intended to be entertainment, and entertainment is generally not free. Coders are expensive. Servers are expensive. Marketing is expensive. So it is a business that's being run. It has to be supported in some way. And again, I'm not trying to advocate by any means that anybody spend money on anything that they can't afford or on a game. I'm just trying to explain the concept. But if it's somebody who is playing a game that they enjoy and they're willing to spend on the game because they know that that contributes to the game being further developed and hopefully being more enjoyable down the road, that is why people would spend money on virtual items. So a skin is a piece of clothing for a character in a video game. I'm going to be honest. I could not see myself spending a dollar a skin. I have no interest in it, but I could certainly see myself spending a little bit extra for a better steak. And that's really where that whole analogy ties in. For some people, skins represent status, whether it's a status of achievement within the game or a status of achievement among their friends, or just they like the aesthetic. For some people, skins have value. To that extent, something that is rare is always worth more than something that's not rare. Same reason that name designer brand clothing costs more, because they produce less of it and it's got more of a cachet to it. So within games, a common skin does not carry a lot of value, but a rare skin does. CSGO has built an economy by selling or making available through other game mechanics skins that can be extraordinarily rare and possibly never received again. And they're not the only game to do it, by the way. So I don't want to call out CSGO. They're the largest marketplace because they have the most players, but they're far from the only ones to do it. And to the best of my knowledge, they're not affiliated with most of the gambling sites we're about to talk about. They're just the mechanic for those gambling sites. But CSGO has something like over a million active daily players, and they have this enormous fan base for the variety of skins that are offered for the different characters in the game. And so if you have a rare skin, you can take that skin to a site, to a website, where you can either bet the skin directly in a game of chance, or you can convert the skin into cash value and utilize that cash value to play blackjack, roulette, slot machines, or other forms of gambling. And what this does is it gives under 21, and particularly under 18, the ability to gain items that have particular value, and then oftentimes exchange those items and engage in real world gambling without age verification, without the need to process a credit card that they may not have access to, and without any way for their parents to know that they're engaging in this gambling. And many of these websites are based offshore outside of US regulated jurisdictions. And I want to be clear, I think all the topics we talked about at the beginning meet the legal definition of gambling. Risk something of value to gain something of value when the outcome is uncertain. What has been the tripping point on this for many years is the question of whether virtual items have value and how that should be perceived. But at this point, we're going beyond that, because we're talking about exchanging virtual items for cash or cash valued currency that has redemptive value. And so now it is actually meeting the legal definition of gambling without debate, and it is still accessible to under 18.
Yeah, I actually saw a video by CoffeeZilla, and I did a reaction to it where he was talking about the structure of CSGO and the casinos that come with it. And one really important part that he had mentioned was they did age verification checks on the withdrawals, but not on the deposits. So there was kids as young as 12, 13, 14 years old going online, gambling, getting themselves hooked to it, and then not even being able to cash out if they were fortunate enough to have a win. If you're in the audience and you want to see that video, then check it out here. And let's keep getting better together, one day at a time.